If you have a Bible, can I encourage you to open it just now? We're going to be in the Gospel of Luke and at chapter 8. There in Luke's Gospel at chapter 8 and at verse 22, you find the story of the storm that Pauline introduced to us earlier with the young folks. Luke 8, chapter 8, verse 22. This is God's word. One day, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let's go over to the other side of the lake." So they got into a boat and set out. As they sailed, he fell asleep. A squall came down on the lake, so that the boat was being swamped and they were in great danger. The disciples went and woke him, saying, "Master, Master, we're going to drown." He got up and rebuked the wind and the raging waters. The storm subsided, and all was calm. "Where is your faith?" he asked the disciples. In fear and amazement, they asked one another, "Who is this? He commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him." This is God's word for us today. When we're thinking about Jesus, and we're thinking about him being the Son of God, and thinking about him having the ability to calm waters and still winds, and when we think about our lives, it creates lots of questions. And those of us who maybe haven't yet come to really understand that Jesus calls us to put our faith in him fully might wonder that with ongoing questions that we therefore cannot trust in Jesus. Well, we've been listening to Andy Bannister from Solus recently, helping us with a little bit of insight into miracles. And today I want to go to Solus again, not Andy Bannister himself, but one of his colleagues, just to ask that question, can we really believe in Jesus even if we don't have answers to everything? Let's hear what Solus says.
Some years ago, I was chatting about God with a non-Christian student on a university campus. He was very open and sincere about exploring his questions and his doubts about God. And he'd actually moved significantly from his original assumption that Jesus was just a superstition to becoming convinced that there was excellent evidence for both belief in God and the historical claims of Jesus specifically. And yet, as we talked together over the course of several days, it became clear to me that as convinced as this guy was about Christianity already, he'd assumed that he could only make a commitment to God and become a Christian after every possible question he could think of was satisfied. So, do we need to have every conceivable question about God answered before we can make a commitment to follow Jesus? Well, the first thing to say about this question is to remember that God is not a thesis. He is a person. In other words, how we relate to God and how God relates to us is not like a theory that needs to be tested and proved abstractly, but like a person whom we increasingly learn to trust in the context of relationship. Think about it this way. The Bible says that one of the best ways of understanding the nature of God's relationship with people is through the analogy of marriage. And of course, marriage is about a relationship of faith. At its most basic level, it's about placing your trust in another person and committing your life and your future to them on the basis of the evidence that you've seen about whether they're trustworthy or whether they're not trustworthy. And of course, the only way that you can come to know another person in that way is by spending time with them and intentionally getting to see and understand who they truly are in a more clear way. When Amy, my wife, and I first started dating, that's exactly what we did. Yes, it was about going for dinners and day trips and spending time with one another. But those things were really vehicles for getting to know one another, understanding each other, asking questions, both spoken and unspoken, about one another, and coming to a realization about who each other were and what we were truly like. And it's exactly on the same basis that God expects us to trust him, by exploring who he is. But at some point along that journey of Amy and I getting to know one another, it became right and appropriate that we would make a commitment to one another and actually get married. Had we exhausted everything we could know about each other or every question that we would ever need to ask? No. Would new questions, maybe even uncertainties, emerge once we were then married? Yes. But the thing is, we knew enough about each other. We'd seen enough evidence to convince us that on the basis of that evidence, it was right to make an informed commitment to one another and be married. If after years of dating, I had told Amy that I wouldn't make a commitment to her until I'd every conceivable question answered, I would never have married her. In fact, in doing so and making that my standard, I would likely have communicated to her that I wasn't actually interested or serious about making a commitment to her, because the criterion by which I'd set in order for me to do so was completely unrealistic. And it's the same with committing your life to Jesus and becoming a Christian. Yes, the initial journey of getting to know God and exploring the evidence for his existence and character is crucial so that we trust God not blindly, but on the basis of that evidence. But if, in all honesty, you're watching this video and you've done that and you've come to the point where you think Jesus is who he claimed to be and he did rise from the dead, I would suggest to you that it's maybe an appropriate time to make that commitment to become a Christian and to start following Jesus. That's what this student ended up doing, and it was fantastic. Now, yes, when you do that, you'll still have questions, maybe even doubts, as all Christians do. But you'll get to work through those with God and with Christian friends and leaders. You don't need to wait until you've every conceivable question answered before you become a Christian. Because if that is our criteria, it might suggest that our questions are simply a distraction from the fact that we may not want to follow God. Why should we hold God to an infinitely higher standard of trustworthiness than we hold other people? So perhaps today is the appropriate time to actually make that commitment and become a Christian. And if you'd like some practical advice on how to do that, then do check out our short answers video on how to become a Christian. And then, once you've done that, send us an email. We'd love to hear about it, and we'd love to help you get started with some resources on your Christian journey. You don't need to wait. You can make a commitment to Jesus Christ today.
And of course, our short video he's talking about are those that are on the Solas website, or you could speak to myself or one of our own folks if you wanted to put your faith in Jesus this day. The last few weeks, we've been watching our... there's an audible Bible, I think, there. Over the last few weeks, we've been in our mini-series, and we've been listening to the stories of how Jesus has performed some miracles. Last week, we were in Luke chapter 5, and that amazing catch of fish. And Jesus invited out of that miracle Simon to bring Jesus into his life, to invite Jesus into his life formally that day, so that by faith, Simon actually would have Jesus in his life forever. And Simon left everything, presumably even the fish that he caught, and began to follow Jesus. And that invitation that we heard of, that Simon Peter was issued that particular day, is an invitation that comes down through the years of time and is one that stands with us today. And it's an invitation to follow Jesus, to put our faith in Jesus, that demands an RSVP. We're to respond to that invitation to follow him and trust in him. Today, that faith is actually at the center of even this passage that we've looked at in chapter 8. We're again at the edge of Lake Tiberias. Some of you have been over to Manhattan in New York, and you know that New York is apparently so great that it's named twice, New York, New York. In fact, actually, Lake Tiberias might be absolutely amazing because it goes by at least three names. It goes by the name Lake Tiberias, it goes by the name Lake Gennesaret, which is what we saw in chapter 5, and it goes by the name the Sea of Galilee. So it must be quite an incredible body of water. And you know that when we read a passage like this, some of us here, I know, are very familiar with it. But what I have come to realize is that some of us who think we're very familiar with it actually may not have read it for some time, and we've kind of forgotten some of the detail. And there are actually some who might be here or some who are watching online for whom this is actually quite a new account. And so what I've tried to do is find some words in the passage that are obvious and there, so that maybe, certainly today in the service, but maybe later if we read it again, we can say, oh, I remember seeing these words and what they meant, as we talked about that in Maxwell one day. So I'm going to pick some words that begin with S here. And the word to begin with is simply the word sailing. The next word is very simple, obviously. It's the word sleeping. The next one, obviously, should try a quiz with this, shouldn't I? Should see if you've got, pull your Bible, who's going to put your hand up first. The next one is the word squall. So we've got sailing, sleeping, squall. And then the last word, which is going to actually occur a few times and in quick repetition, is the word spoke. And I'm going to kind of sneak that one in at the end. But the first word is sailing. So here we are in Lake Tiberias. Jesus, by his instigation again, has got the disciples getting a boat out and going back onto the water, as we saw last week. But it's not this week to fish, but this time actually is to get them across the lake. So if you look at verse 22, you see that he's inviting them to get the boat off the land, as it were, push it out and take the few of them that are there over to the other side of the lake. Now, these chaps have been around this lake many times. In fact, they're fishermen, and not only fishermen, but they're local fishermen. And we also saw last week that they were inclined sometimes to spend the night, the whole night, on the lake. And so they would know these waters pretty well. That lake is not huge. It's about 8 miles wide, about 12 miles long. It's about 30-odd miles round. And for some of you, that would be a nice, easy cycle ride. But for a walk, especially in the evening, at the end of a very busy day, actually, it would be quite a challenge. And so Jesus does the sensible thing and says, let's get in the boat. He has access to the boat, so they're going to use it. So verse 22, let's go over to the other side of the lake. And Luke doesn't tell us why Jesus wants them to go across at that particular moment for a landing on the other side. But they do what he asks. And as we saw last week, that's what the Lord wants us to do. It could be just something very simple, like pushing the boat out, taking us across the lake. And the disciples comply. And it's step by step, just moment by moment, trusting Jesus, listening to what he asks of us, and doing it. And so they do. So that's the first word, sailing. The second word is sleeping. Well, it seems that they haven't really got too far out into the water. And Jesus actually puts himself in the back of the boat, curls up, and goes to sleep, verse 22 to 23. So they got in the boat and set out, and they sailed, and he fell asleep. Now, the point of this passage is not what I'm about to say, okay? But I do think it's quite interesting that this man, who is the Son of God, who has demonstrated his authority in so many ways and his power, but is also a human being, and is gathering a following who are following, not least these disciples in the boat, he's not afraid to show what humans are like when they've worked hard. They get tired and they have to sleep. And so even though he's only just really begun to be followed by these disciples, he's not trying to impress them by showing himself to be some kind of superman. Emphasis on the superman, because he's tired and therefore he sleeps. Now, the reason I'm saying this is because if you think about some of our politicians or maybe even the presidents that we see around, how do they project themselves? Well, they jog up to the podium, or you see them first thing in the morning out jogging with their Secret Service, who are laboring because they're not able to keep up with this really super fit president. Or what do they present about their work ethic? Well, they're up crack of dawn to work, and you get pictures of them working late into the night as though they don't need to rest or sleep like normal people. What does Jesus show? Jesus shows himself in all his humanity. He's tired and he needs to sleep, and so he sleeps. And the reason I mention it to you is because at the heart of this passage is really us being invited to, again, recognize who Jesus is and to trust in him, but trust in him with everything. Those of you who are still at work, for example, could you trust in Jesus so much that when you are tired and wearied by the working day, could you trust Jesus enough to say to your employer or your employees, I can't do that. I need to go and sleep. I need to have a day of rest. I'm not going to do that project on Sunday because I need to have a day off. Could you risk doing that? Could your faith in Jesus be so real that because you're a human being like everyone else and actually get tired sometimes, you could risk being open about that and saying, yeah, I've got this weakness, I need to sleep. The passage is not about that, but I think it's so interesting to see Jesus as he gathers people around him, just showing what you do in humanity when you have a need, and that is you sleep. And so he goes to the back of the boat and he begins to sleep. Verse 23, as they sailed, he fell asleep. And the third S then is the word squall. Now, it turns out, for those of you who are a little bit familiar with the area that we're talking about in northeast Israel, that this lake is actually the second lowest lake in the world. In fact, it's second only to the Dead Sea, which is just down the road in Israel also. Lake Tiberias is also shallow, and it's only at the deepest part, something like 43 meters deep. Now, surrounded with some mountains as well, the reason I mention this is because it can therefore be quite a place of storms, shallow, warm water, high mountains. Weather changes and weather patterns can move in a moment. And so suddenly the possibility of a squall, as it says in verse 23, is actually very real. And wind is significant here because wind is mentioned three times in verse 23, 24, and 25. And actually this that we translate squall is actually literally could be translated a windstorm of wind. Well, if you just put yourself there for a second, if you've ever been out in a squall, a windstorm of wind, not only is it quite alarming because of the forces that it brings on you physically, but the noise is terrifying. When we were ministering overseas, there was a hurricane. And of course, we settled down and barricaded ourselves in. We put our girls, who were both young at the time, into a cupboard that had no windows, and we secured things. And Anita and I ran around getting the water out of the flat that we were in. The next day, when it subsided, when the hurricane had gone, we went outside, but there was still a wind. And one of our girls actually started to cry because of the fear, the noise and the force of the wind, even though it wasn't now a hurricane. Well, you can imagine the fear and the terror that would grip these sailors, not only because of the noise and the wind, but because it was so real that the boat was now being tossed around so much that water would be coming in. It's evening time, although the water by and large is warmer water in Lake Tiberias at that time of night. In that context, they would have cold water lapping in amongst them. It must have been an awful sensory experience for them as they were going through that. And as sailors, they would realize just how dangerous this was. And so verse 24 tells us that it was so alarming for them that they then went to Jesus, their master, and said, "We're going to drown." This is the logical conclusion out of what's happening here. We're going to drown because the storm was so awful. And it's very interesting as you read this that they go to Jesus in verse 24 and they wake him. I don't think it's a bit like when you go into your living room and, you know, your spouse or your child or whoever it is sleeping and you kind of go, and you just kind of rub enough till eventually they go and look to. And I think basically it says there's more than one disciple goes to Jesus here, verse 24. The disciples go and they wake him. It's like they surround him. I suspect they're grabbing him, they're shouting at him, and they're saying, "Master, Master, we're going to drown." They're absolutely beside themselves, as we would say. And what makes this more interesting is here they are doing what Jesus wants them to do. You get that? It's Jesus who said to them, "Let's go to the other side. Let's get the boat. Let's do this." So they're doing what Jesus wants them to do, but actually it's creating a situation where they are more than anxious. And the circumstances are real. These are not felt things. These are real circumstances that are surrounding them. Sometimes in our lives, in the mystery of things that bombard us day in, day out, and are real things, real pains, real losses, real fears, real experiences, things that actually, if there is not some intervention, will drown us, will overtake us, will swamp us because they're so real. It's interesting in the mystery of that, that sometimes we're told or asked, well, where is Jesus in that? Where's Jesus in that? And I think sometimes when we're encouraged to ask that question, the way that we are encouraged to ask the question is to suggest that maybe, well, he's absent. He's not there. He doesn't care. He's outside of this. He's unconcerned. He's unaware. It's striking this here. Jesus is asking them to follow his instructions, his desires, and they do so. They get in the boat. And where is Jesus when the storm hits? He's actually right there with them. He's not unaware. He's not absent. He's not outside. He does care because it's his plan that they're following. And he's right there close to them. But the storm still hit. Now, there's no doubt, there's mystery in this, and some of the questions that we might, as Christians, be asking through our Christian life might be with other people. Why did that happen at that particular time? And it could be that as Christians, we don't get to hear the answer to that particular question at this time. It might be that maybe we have to end up waiting until we're in the Lord's presence to say, Lord, do you remember that happened? I didn't understand that. Why did that happen? And maybe we have to live with that not knowing. Maybe the apostles maybe had to live with that unknowing. But it happened. There was a storm. It was fearfully real. And Jesus was right there with them. Right there with them. It wasn't a sign of God's judgment. It wasn't a sign that they had gone off and done their own thing and departed from the will of God. Not so. In fact, actually, as they followed Jesus' instruction, the storm had hit, and they were filled with terror. I think that when we are being assailed in the various moments of life that we can be assailed in, whether it's with ill health or financial worries or relationship difficulties or even the prospect one day of death or all the other things that fill us with daily angst, as we walk with Jesus and we ask, Lord, why is that happening just now? And we might well pray that. I think we wouldn't want to ask that question with the assumption, because you can't be in this with me, or you have been distant, or you're unaware of it, or you're not capable of changing the circumstances. No, none of that. And we're going to see more of what the Lord Jesus says to them about how in the midst of this storm, he's basically going to say to them, well, in the midst of this storm, where is your faith? Where is your faith? So they're sailing, they are sleeping, there's squall, and then we have in the final S, the word spoke. Making this word spoke fit. Obviously, the others are right there, but this word spoke is first Jesus speaking to the winds, to the winds and to the waves. And so as Jesus wakes, and no doubt because they were shaking and shouting at him in verse 24, it says he got up, he was lying down, he was having a really good sleep here, he was actually lying down, he got up and he spoke, he rebuked the wind and the raging waters. He spoke to them in by way of rebuke. Now, I think some of us who know this passage are quite familiar with it. We know that he did that. But here's my question to you, first of all. Why did he do that? Why did he speak to the wind and the waters? And what I mean, especially when I ask that question, is you are familiar, aren't you, with the fact that wind and water do not have ears and they actually cannot hear. Therefore, why would Jesus speak to them? Well, for various reasons that we might, if we chewed this over for a while, come out with, I think one of them is to make very clear to the disciples who are with them and to those who will later read of this account, including ourselves, what actually happened here. Let me tell you a silly story. It might be Let me back up before my silly story and say, you might imagine this. Jesus is woken up and he gets up and he stands and he looks out and it all goes calm. And the disciples say, wow, that's an amazing coincidence. When Jesus stood up, everything went calm. Or a silly story where a man's going for a job interview. I suspect it because of this little story. It's down at the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital. He really needs to get there on time and he can't find the parking space. And so he goes round the car park and round and round, and he really needs this job, otherwise they're going to starve. He needs to get this job. He needs to get there in time. He needs to get this interview. He needs to get this. And he's going round and round, and there's no car parking space. And so he prays. He prays, Lord, I really need this job, and I really need to get parked now in order to get this job. And suddenly, right then, right in front of him, reversing lights go on. Car reverses out, pulls off, he pulls straight in. What do you say? What do you say? Well, he was thinking to himself, maybe, oh, that was lucky. Or he then turns to the Lord and says in prayer, it's okay, Lord, I found one. Jesus, I think, is making crystal clear here what's going on. He audibly speaks to the wind and the waves, so the disciples know here is the one who is calming the water. Here is the one who is stilling the winds. He is the one who is in control of the laws of nature because they're his laws. Here is the one who maybe in their mind, they say, do you know, did we not read something of this in the Psalms? So back in Psalm 89, when it says, you rule over the surging sea. When its waves mount up, you still them. The psalmist speaking of God. Maybe also in Psalm 107, where it says from the psalmist, then they cried out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brought them out of their distress. He stilled the storm to a whisper. The waves of the seas were hushed. And Jesus stands up and says, be still. He could almost have used the words from Psalm 46. He could have almost then said, be still, I'm God. But he spoke, and the raging waters and the storm subsided, and all was calm. It was like a mill pond, and the disciples stood up. And can you imagine what they would have thought? Well, we don't have to imagine too much, because in fact, in a moment or two, Jesus is going to hear as they hear from one another, because another S for spoke is that the disciples spoke to one another. In verse 25, it says, in fear and amazement, they spoke to one another. They asked one another, who is this? Even the winds and the water obey him. And Jesus spoke to them, also in verse 25. And it was something of a rhetorical question. It was a question that he really didn't want them to answer right at that moment. I think it's a question that he wanted to put to them and say, have a think about this. Have a think about this. As you follow me, have a think about this. And the question that he asks them as he speaks to them in verse 25 is, where is your faith? And of course, that question for them is a question for us today. But first of all, it's a question for us as a church. You know, one of the ways that one of the main reasons that Luke would have written this gospel is not simply for us as individuals, though that would be true, but actually he was writing the gospel for the church. He was writing for the church, even of his generation, that were going through terrible times. They were going through persecution. There was Jews who would oppose them. There was Romans who would kill them. And the persecution of the church, when Luke was recording all of this and researching all of this, the persecution was awful. And he's writing to those who are in a absolute storm in life, which actually could take their lives. It could be that, using the words of the disciples here, they're about to drown, as it were, but not drown in water, although they might get drowned in water, but more likely drown in some other kind of death or pain. And Jesus' words to the church in that situation is, where is your faith? Some of you know that the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland is currently, or just finished yesterday, it's been on this last week or so, and some of us have been very aware of some of the news that they're going to have massive cutbacks where the ministers and other workers are, you know, hundreds are going to be chopped out of the church life The finances are down, numbers are down, you know, everything's down basically. The church seems to be flagging in every particular way, and it feels like there's a perfect storm. It seems like the church is declining, the property needs to be rebuilt, removed to a different place, and revisioning seems to be happening of our theology and our morality, and it's like a perfect storm. And Jesus says, where is your faith? Where is your faith located? Certainly not in the structures of a denomination, certainly not in the power or wisdom or will of mankind, of human beings. Where is your faith? What was Jesus inviting them to think about and respond with in the face of the one who calms the sea and stills the waves? But obviously this question applies to us individually as well. It's not Jesus like an anonymous fireman who runs into a particular crisis there and then disappears and says, you know, right, ma'am, that's what I do. And then maybe pops back up the next time we've got a 999 request. No, what Jesus does, as we saw last week, and as we'll see every week, no doubt, in this church, is he invites us into a relationship with him. He calls us to follow him and to know that as we follow him, he's with us. And in fact, his word is true when he says, I'll never leave you. I'll never leave you. I'll never forsake you. And so for us personally, you know, as we go into what is, in their circumstances, a very real situation. There is nothing that's just simply, you know, a kind of feeling here. It's real. They're being killed by the wind and the waves. If nothing happens, they're going to die. And that's real for us. We are in situations which are real. Some of them are terrifying. Some of them are painful. Some of them, we don't know where we're going to end up. Some of them fill our hearts with grief. Some of us have got diagnoses that leave us lying awake at night. And Jesus says to us in our storm, where is your faith? I think it's a rhetorical question that he asked the disciples, not to scold them and leave them scolded, but really to actually say to them, what did you just see? What did you just hear? Do you think you can trust me with your life? Do you think you can trust me with your death? They thought they were going to die. They thought their death was going to come sooner than they had maybe one day imagined. Can you trust me with your life? Do you have faith in me for your life? Do you have faith in me for your death? It's a question that in the next chapter, Jesus is going to put again to them. And he's going to say in chapter 9, verse 20, yeah, but who do you say that I am? My question to myself as I was reading this is the same question I would put to you, and that is, when Jesus came into this world, God the Son, and walked as a human being, and I've come to know that he did that for me, that when I realized that he went, as we have been singing about, to the cross of Calvary, knowing what I'm like, really knowing what I'm like. Not, you know, we say, well, we all sin, and we can kind of say these words because we don't actually really imagine what it means, that kind of grotesqueness and the hurt that we create to ourselves and to others when we sin and the offense we cause God. We say, well, we sin, but actually it's awful, our sin, awful before God, awful to ourselves, awful to one another, awful to our world. And when I know that he really knows me and he would die to take that sin away, that he would die to take the burden of God's judgment from me away. And when I know that he came into this world a human being, God the Son, and that dying on the third day, he rose from the dead bodily. And he did that so that one day I will have a bodily resurrection with him. And I can be excited to know that even though I'm likely to live only whatever number of years at this stage, there will be a resurrection life. And I think to myself, well, which storm that hits me now is one that I would say, well, that's a bit big for him to handle. That's one that he didn't know was coming. That's one where he is not present, unaware, outside, unconcerned. Is that our faith? And so Jesus says this, where is your faith? Where is your faith? Let me just make this little analogy to finish. Somebody compared the pressures of storms in our lives to the clamp that a carpenter might put on wood that he's glued together or she has glued together. But you need to put this clamp on to hold it till the bond is fixed. And you need the pressure to make the bond work. And the crises, the fearful times, the storms, as it were, are the pressures, the pressure points that bond our faith. And we need them. Where is your faith? And if there's anyone still asking, who is this man, Jesus? What he's demonstrated is that he is the one with authority over nature because he's God the Son. Take a moment for quiet prayer.